Andy Schiltz is the author of a new book. It's called The Mayor of Castro Street, The Life and Times of Harvey Milk. He writes that the story of Milk already existed in the lives and minds of millions of gays. He lived, Schiltz writes, as a metaphor for the homosexual experience in America. Schiltz is one of the very few openly gay journalists in the country who works with the mainstream press. He lives in San Francisco. For the past 6 years, he's covered City Hall and the gay community. He's been a television and newspaper reporter. He's currently with the San Francisco Chronicle. Randy Schiltz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You say that Milk is a metaphor for the homosexual experience in America. What do you mean by that?
Well, those are sort of words that fell out of my typewriter at the end. You know, things you don't always plan on what's going to come out. And doing the research for it to write the book was what I was trying to write was a gay James Michener book, essentially. And I read every book that Michener wrote because I wanted to talk about, you know, so people would understand, so my mom and dad would understand what this craziness in San Francisco in the late 70s was all about. And in reviewing Harvey's life, Harvey was born in 1930, and he led the typical gay life. He was a linebacker on his high school football team in Long Island. He was a decorated naval officer during the Korean War. Was a Goldwater Republican stock analyst, and all the time knowing he was gay, leading a fairly active gay life, but compartmentalizing his life, keeping it separate, and the way that sort of gay people had done for decades before and during that time, and his whole life reflected the gay life in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And then he made this emergence or a convergence with history as he became involved in the gay movement in San Francisco and came to lead the gay movement in San Francisco. And he's a metaphor on one level in that his life reflected his times. And I think the reason that I came up, why it hit me at the end, that Harvey's story about how he went against all odds as a politician, he went against all odds. He broke every rule as far as being an openly gay person. And finally, after fighting and fighting, he won. And then he was shot down. He was killed. And the person who killed him essentially got away with murder. And to gay people, and actually if you ask most gay people in most places across the country, they don't know much about Harvey Milk. All they know is that he fought against the odds. He got killed. The guy who killed him got away with it. And it became the stuff of which legends are made because it made sense, because that's sort of what gay people have always been having to put up with. You fight and fight, and if you win, you can get shot down, and the person who does it can get away with it because they've always gotten away with it. And in that sense, I think it's sort of it's a metaphor. Legends, I think, exist in people's minds even before they happen. And this was certainly, the case with Harvey. With Harvey, it's just that he was such a theatrical, funny person that he just made a better story.
You went and interviewed people who knew him throughout different parts of his life. And, of course, you interviewed his high school classmates and college fraternity mates and women who knew him. And a lot of people described him as a man's man. He was a football hero. What would have made it impossible for him, this man's man, football hero, to come out and be openly gay in, say, the 50s?
Well, what was interesting is, like, going back and talking to the people he went to high school with, they'd also tell me about the class sissy who got beat up in the locker room. I'd talk to people in college and find out, you know, and they'd tell me about what it was like for the people who were identified as being gay. And with Harvey, he went to a teacher's college. Being identified as being gay meant that he would have lost his teaching job and what he wanted to do for a career. Being in the Navy during the mid-1950s would have meant that he would have gotten kicked out and been disgraced for the rest of his life. And you've got to remember, when you get a homosexual discharge, that especially back then, that haunted you forever and was always something that was checked into if you're applying for jobs. And it was all those social pressures, which all gay people faced, that Harvey faced, and that kept him in the closet like it kept other people in the closet.
The people who you interviewed by this time knew he was gay. Mm-hmm. What was their reaction to it? Did they care?
It was something. Like many gay people, Harvey divorced himself from his past and never went back and talked to the people in high school, never went back and talked to the people in college. And what surprised me so much was how much they respected him and how much because they kept up with him, especially once he got involved in politics in San Francisco. And they'd clip out the newspaper stories about him and circulate them, because there's endless newspaper stories about him. And they always wanted to pat him on the back because they were proud that he'd made it, because they had always sensed that he was somebody different. And of course, being different different for him was being tied up with being gay, but they could also always sense that he was an individualist, and everybody always liked him, and that explains why. And that had to do with why people liked him in high school, with why, and the same thing that the reasons that Teamsters endorsed him, is he could get along with anybody.
As you said, he was gay, but this didn't come out at all in his professional life or with his straight friends. What was it in his life or in the world around him that made him make a connection between politics and being gay?
If you wanted to write Harvey's life as fiction, you'd never be able to pull it off because it's such an unlikely twist that his life took when he was in his 40s. Throughout his early life, all of his friends say that even though he was very good, say, at being a Wall Street stock analyst and fit the mold, very conservative, he was always very unsettled. Like, people had the sense that he didn't know what he wanted to do when he grew up, even way past the time he was growing up. But because one of his boyfriends was involved in the theater crowd, specifically with Tom O'Horgan, who is remembered for directing Hair and Jesus Christ Superstar, Harvey became involved in these people and went hippie at the unlikely age of 41. And I think, and this also, I think, reflects to a large extent what a lot of gay people did, because for many gay people, the counterculture represented the time when they finally came out, because the whole idea is do your own thing. And pretty soon, a lot of people began realizing that do your own thing had more applications than merely growing your hair long and wearing bell-bottom pants and beads. And so doing your own thing also meant, hey, why not, you know, like yourself and do your own thing sexually. And that's when Harvey came out and moved to San Francisco. Now, at that time, say in the early 70s, he moved 71, 72, the Haight-Ashbury had been pretty well taken over by junkies. The dream had faded in terms of the hippie dream. But right over the hill from Haight-Ashbury was this rundown street called Castro Street. It was an Irish neighborhood, inner-city neighborhood that had gone to seed. I think here in Philadelphia, San Francisco is an extremely like Philadelphia in as much as it's a city of neighborhoods. And this was one of the neighborhoods that had decayed. Well, what happened was that somebody opened a gay bar there. And so all the gay hippies started going from across the hill from Haight-Ashbury to this rundown street. They soon found, since it was rundown, there was cheap rents. Harvey and his boyfriend were looking for an apartment, and they found their cheapest rent in Castro Street, and they opened up a little store. And then Harvey, always being analytical, and also, but he's 42, so he's much older than a lot of the people, even though he had hair down to the middle of his back and a big beard and mustache. He realized that this could be a real unique opportunity, and that the Castro Street in the 70s could become for gay people what the Haight-Ashbury had been in the 60s, where it could gel a certain sociological experience. And so he set up a little camera store, and not that he was ever – he was a terrible businessman, but it was essentially his little vest pocket City Hall. And he went and met everybody. If a little old lady wanted to get a stop sign put in so that her grandchild could walk to school better, she'd go to Harvey Milk's camera store, because Harvey Milk would know where to go in City Hall to get that fixed. If people were having a hard time getting the street sweeped, Harvey took care of that. It functioned as sort of an aldermanic headquarters in the finest tradition of Irish ward politics. And so very slowly, Harvey began to see the possibility of what a neighborhood could do, of what a true gay community could do. And not just this nebulous, people talk about the gay community. Never trust a politician who uses the word gay community. But the people talk about, but he saw that, hey, you could build a neighborhood, a community where people could live, and finally where gay people could have a place where they were not the oddball out, where they were the ones who set the standards. And so what he did was the most basic thing in American politics. He started registering voters. Whenever there's a slow day in the camera shop, and there are many slow days, he takes a little card table out, put it right on the sidewalk, and pull people off the sidewalk and make sure that they got registered to vote, preferably Democratic. And he'd register people to vote, and he started the first gay business organization, because he said if people are going to take us seriously, they're only going to take us seriously if we can threaten them, if we can either offer them economic clout or threaten to take it away from them, or have political clout, which is votes. And when you look at the slow evolution of power in San Francisco, and particularly in the Castro, it's votes and money, which is really sort of the all-American way.
In a lot of cities, the problem that people have been running up against and trying to organize a group with gay clout, economic or political, is that a lot of people don't want to come out, which is what you have to do in order to visibly organize into this group with clout. Was it hard for him to get people to organize and be visible?
It would have been, except San Francisco was so influenced by the hippie phenomena, and there were so many young gay people who began who were there to start with from the hippie phenomena, and then who started. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. People heard about Castro Street. I was living in Oregon at the time, and in the early 70s, I started hearing about this street that was all gay people, and that you could go there and live your entire life and work and shop and play and never come in contact with a heterosexual. I mean, no, some of my best friends are heterosexuals, but it got a reputation, and so more and more people started immigrating. And by the mid 70s, it was a mass migration of really what amounted to tens of thousands of gay people coming to San Francisco, not only because it was so great there, but because it's so bad everywhere else. And so there was a highly visible gay population centering in this neighborhood, So that would get publicity. The more publicity it got, the more people came, and it became more and more of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And whenever they came down to Castro Street, Harvey made sure they were registered to vote. And he was always saying, vote gay, shop gay, because we've got to help ourselves out. We can't depend on the kindness of liberals. And that was how very slowly and gradually he built up what is now the international gay mecca in San Francisco. And it was done in a very prosaic way, votes and money.
How did he use the gay bars in organizing?
He would do things like when there was a strike early on in his political career. There was a strike against the beer distributors. The Teamsters were trying to get a decent pay raise from the beer distributors, and the Teamsters just couldn't break them. They got the Chinese grocers, they got the Arab grocers to not take scab drivers, but they couldn't break it. And finally, one of these Teamsters who grew up in the Castro and had heard about this Harvey Milk guy went down to the camera store and said, "Gee, we need help." So Harvey went to all the gay bars and said, "Okay," and got all the gay bars together and they would not take beer driven by scab drivers, and it broke the distributors, and the Teamsters won the strike. From then on, Harvey had the endorsement of the Teamster Union in the city. The Teamsters went to the Hard Hat Union, the largest union in the city, and said, "Hey, this guy backed us up." And in a very and as one of the Hard Hat leaders very prosaically put it, "You don't screw your friends." And so they backed Harvey. They went to the Firefighters Union. Harvey was in San Francisco. That's a major issue since we're going to be leveled, by an earthquake at any time. Harvey studied up on his firefighters issues, and he got his endorsement from the firefighters. It's real interesting because in New York, I believe Philadelphia and Chicago, when gay rights issues come up before the city council, it's the firefighters who get freaked out because they're always at the forefront of being against gay rights because essentially they don't want to have to bunk up with homos, I think, is sort of the reason. But in San Francisco in 1975, the Firefighters Union was on record as endorsing Harvey Milk to become the first openly gay city official in the country. And it's because of that kind of work of just going in there and organizing and showing what we had to offer, but also asking for something in return.
Not to play too much on stereotypes, but it seems really unlikely that the Teamsters would be supporting a gay group, since you'd think if you're going to use stereotypes that would be one of the more homophobic unions. What was it like for them? I'm sure you spoke with some of the people who were in the team.
There were jokes. They made a lot of jokes at first, but the thing is, Harvey had that nebulous quality of charisma, and he could go talk to anybody, and he would go to talk. And for a lot of them, it was the first time they'd met a gay person, and they actually got a chance to talk to one. Because all the other gay leaders at the time were playing the game with liberal friends. You don't identify with labor because labor at that time, there was a very strong anti-labor backlash in San Francisco because of a number of city strikes. And so they weren't going to identify themselves with labor. They were just being responsible gay leaders who weren't going to rock the boats with our liberal friends, as they were constantly called. And they would not run gay people for office because they were afraid that would scare our liberal friends away. And Harvey had to really go up against these people because he believed in building a grassroots alliances, and that's what would make politics work. And I think Harvey could also get away with it in San Francisco because we are a small city, so it's a lot more human. You can have that contact, and Harvey was able to tell if Teamster told a queer joke, Harvey would come right back with a funnier one, and they could all laugh and get over it.
Let me reintroduce you, Randy. Randy Schultz is my guest, and he's written a new book on Harvey Milk called The Mayor of Castro Street, The Life and Times of Harvey Milk, and it's published by the St. Martin's Press. Now, he also had a break into the Democratic Party as well as winning alliances with groups around the city. Was the party receptive to him?
No, because they really preferred dealing with the realtors and the gay lawyers who didn't want to rock the boat. And all the liberal Democrats would have to do is go to their cocktail parties and pat them on the back and say, yes, we like homosexuals. And they'd say, oh, fine. You know, and they didn't demand anything. And Harvey said, you've got to demand. You've got to decide what you'd want. For years, we'd been electing public officials there. Gay people had been, and the gay people got no appointments, no commissionerships. And Harvey considered the responsible gay leaders to be Uncle Toms, as he'd call them. And so he came and was very pushy, and the Democrats didn't want to have anything to do with him.
Were they convinced yet that there was an important voting bloc amongst gays?
But they could get that voting bloc through the leaders without having to give anything in return. And Harvey was saying, hey, it's about time we get our piece of the pie. You know, if you want our votes, you give us something. This horrified the moderates, the gay moderates. They were just shocked, because they were so worried that by rocking the boat, they might lose what little they'd gained. And so Harvey was not only fighting the liberal Democratic establishment, he had to fight the moderate gay leaders, but he kept running for supervisor. 73, he ran for supervisor with long hair, a mustache, and a beard, and came in 10th out of like 30 candidates, and for six seats. And he did. People were saying, "Who is this guy?" And then 1975, there were six seats up. He came in 7th. He was one slot away from winning a seat on the board of supervisors. And that was the time that George Moscone was elected mayor. And George, seeing the wisdom of the numbers, took Harvey under his arm and made Harvey the first openly gay commissioner of any city in the country. And it was. Through that, Harvey built a grassroots political machine, and it wasn't dependent on help from liberal friends or Democrats. It was dependent solely on the power based really strongly in the Castro, and it was also the most liberal voting bloc in the city.
He also knew how to use the media. How did he get the media to? How did he put on
Harvey,
a good
he
show
was
for
a,
them?
Man, he was always a showman. I mean, this guy was a theater. I mean, we've been talking serious politics and stuff here, but he was always good with the joke. And he once told me, that he'd never say anything bad to a reporter. Always be nice to reporters. In fact, doing the book, I found out he thought I was sort of an obnoxious reporter, but he never told me that because he was always nice to reporters. But there's one, for example, when he was a member of the board of supervisors when he finally got elected in 1977. Every survey in the city had shown that the problem of dog feces on the sidewalk was people's number one complaint about living in a big city, because everywhere you walked, you'd step in this stuff. So Harvey's politics were basically you deal with the issues that affect people's lives. He didn't have any abstruse political theories or anything. He just wanted to help people's lives and also get a front page. So he sponsored a dog pooper scooper ordinance, which, of course, passed the Board of Supervisors, was the most popular thing he ever did. And knowing that it would get a lot of press, on the day that it came out for a vote, about 6 o'clock in the morning, he went out to this park near his house and was walking up and down the park and finally found a pile of dog feces. Later in the day, right before the board was going to vote on it, he had all the TV cameras and the newspaper reporters come and to the park, because he was going to show us pooper scooper thing works. So he had all these plastic dog turds, and he put them on the ground and was saying, oh, this is how it works, and they're funny ones. And then just when he'd picked up the bag, he stepped back into the pile of the real stuff that he'd spent all morning looking for, and everybody took pictures, and it was the lead story. And it was that kind of thing where he did the showmanship. But in a more profound way, he really liked it. Was a showmanship. It got his name on the A Wire. It made him a real popular character. He was loved by all groups of San Francisco because he was funny and could do this. But also, he thought it was important because here he was, known as the gayest supervisor, the first one who'd made it, and he was getting front page publicity for an issue that had nothing to do with homosexuality, for which just about everybody in the city agreed with him on, and he was showing straight people that, hey, see, we can do something for you too, we've got something to contribute to.
But did he get criticized at all from gays who felt that he should be paying more attention to gay issues? I mean, here he was, the first openly gay supervisor. Why waste time on dog turds?
Because he didn't really get too much flack once he got in, because he did so well on gay issues. And his term was dominated, the last part was dominated by the Briggs Initiative, which was the law that was put on the ballot for a statewide vote that would have banned gay people from teaching in public schools. And that overwhelmed the second part of his term, and he had essentially travel up and down the state and fight to defeat that initiative, which, of course, it ultimately was by over 1 million votes. And it was a battle that every other gay leader said was hopeless. globalists that you can't, you know, we're not going to win. You know, we shouldn't even fight it because that will only make it more embarrassing when we lose. But Harvey said when something that wrong is going on in the world, you've got to fight it. And he did fight it, and he did win. And he also championed the causes of Asian Americans. He was very big on Asians, senior citizens, and disabled. And because he felt that was, you know, he wasn't there just to be a professional homosexual. He was there to be a supervisor for the concerns of the people. And I think that's another reason why he went over so well, because it was obvious that he wasn't parochial.
You mentioned in your book that you didn't interview a lot of lesbians about Harvey Milk because he didn't really communicate with that many, and that the gays who he organized were really gay men, and the lesbians weren't so much in support of him, nor apparently did he try to work with him very much.
Most of the lesbian leaders were involved in the moderate gay leadership, which opposed him from day one. And so they didn't like him. And so he didn't develop an awful lot of relationships with lesbians. And in San Francisco, it is an overwhelmingly gay male scene. Most of the lesbians, for economic reasons, have gone to the East Bay, Oakland, and Berkeley, because San Francisco is so expensive. And lesbians have, because if you're dealing with couples, you're dealing with women who don't get paid as much as men do, so they have to live in places where it's cheaper. And so a lot of the lesbian scene has gravitated toward the East Bay. And as a writer, I just, you know, as a biographer, I couldn't make it up. You know, I put in lesbian characters who were there and tried to explain their experience as well as I could, but it couldn't be a salient theme of the book just because of the way reality happened.
So, but you say they also disliked him. What were their reasons?
Because Harvey aligned himself early on. Well, first because they were the moderates and they were the ins, and he was an out, and so he was a threat to their power. And because most of the politics in San Francisco before Harvey had not been the radical kind of gay liberation front politics that you'd seen in, say, New York, and to some extent here in Philadelphia. It was always pretty much work within the system, register voter type politics. And they didn't have any use for this guy who aligned himself with drag queens and things like that, and really was trying to represent the shirtless ones, you know, the disenfranchised. That was always Harvey's people from the streets were his constituents.
Did he work on any feminist issues?
Oh yeah, he was extremely good. And when the time came to fight the Briggs Initiative, he was very co-sexual, you know, and always had a woman spokesperson with him, an outstanding woman spokesperson, Sally Gearhart, who's very well known in both feminist and lesbian circles.
He gave a lot of speeches. What were some of the themes that he thought would be useful in mobilizing people?
Hope. Harvey was. Yeah, very similar to Hubert Humphrey in one sense, that what he felt a gay public official could do more than anything else is give people hope, because he'd spent his childhood being told that the only way you could be a homosexual was to be a drag queen or a child molester or something like that. And it was so important for him to reach out to the teenagers in the small towns across the country who could look up to somebody like him and see that, gee, if this guy can, you know, if this crazy wacko, you know, gay Jew can make it, then so can they. And that was the theme of it. It was this hope speech is what everybody called it. And it was his most dramatic oratory. And also he believed very strongly in the new right was beginning to rear its ugly head at that time. And he was felt very strongly that they were co-opting the American dream. That, like, they claim that, you know, here are homosexuals in San Francisco, you know, being un-American and undermining what America stands for. And we were making it in the most American of ways by electing public officials and registering voters. And he talked a lot about America and what America stands for. And he believed that the gay push for acceptance and for gay rights was in the finest of American traditions. And so he talked a lot about America. He was a flag waver.
Now, someone else who was coming up in San Francisco politics at the time was Jim Jones, who we all know about now, but no one really knew then or what we'd know him for. He used some of Jones's volunteers. What did he think of the Jones organization?
He thought they're crazy. He said, "You get help where you take it." He was more afraid of what would happen if he refused Jim Jones's help than what they could do. Even though he believed you just take help where you take it, wherever you can find it. But there are some very chilling anecdotes that I ran across of people who would go to People's Temple to say drop off leaflets, and it was the place was the horror story. It was obvious that there was something wrong to an awful lot of people, and Harvey was one of the only politicians who, at least in private, would question what was going on in that place. And he was always very suspicious of religion anyway, given the trends of fundamentalist at that time.
So he tried to keep them at their distance, but he used them to, what, lick envelopes or whatever?
Yeah, he'd use them and to drop off, to do lit drop-offs in the black neighborhoods. They were good volunteers for the black neighborhoods. And then, of course, in the end, he had the sickest sense of humor. He spent the last week of his life telling Jonestown jokes. But he used them, even though in like one race they were supporting his opponent, but then they realized that Harvey might win, so not only did they help his opponent, but they helped Harvey. And so his reaction was, well, screw him. You know, and so he used him. And that was sort of his attitude. It's politics. Politics is a nasty business. And Harvey was into the nitty-gritty of politics.
Let me reintroduce you again, Randy. Randy Schultz is my guest, and his new book is called The Mayor of Castro Street, The Life and Times of Harvey Milk. And he's a journalist in San Francisco. He's really one of the few openly gay journalists working with the mainstream press in the country. He covers the gay community and City Hall. You say that about this time, San Francisco politics were becoming very polarized, the left and the right, with not much of a center. What was responsible for that? Why was that happening?
I think it's the same thing that's happening nationally, and this is what I think the book has got significance beyond San Francisco, because we were polarized on the lifestyle issues, and what's polarizing America now is the lifestyle issues. It's not so much economics, it's not as strong economics, but it's things like abortion, and it's things like gay rights, and it's because we're at a time now where our values, a significant amount of our population, has dramatically shifted our values away from the old rigid value structure of decades past, of when the church ran the show. And I mean, it used to be in San Francisco, the archbishop had veto power over the fire commission and over the police commission. And that was those were the old days when everything was simple and the Catholic Church could run the show because it was a heavily Catholic city. So you had that tradition, and then you had the emergence of the counterculture of the hippies who had different lifestyle values, and you had the emergence, and then the giant gay invasion, which in San Francisco, being such a small city, these tens of thousands of people who moved there during a relatively short period of time had a major impact on voting patterns. By the time Harvey was elected to the Board of Supervisors, about one out of four voters were gay. And that's an incredible impact. So what you had was that the split of not of issues of rich or poor. It wasn't a class split. It was the issues of are you going to have a new lifestyle? Are you going to have somebody like George Moscone who was for legalizing marijuana and who was for free abortions and for gay rights, as opposed to the old Catholic Italian line? And that was really the polarization of the city, and I think that's what you're seeing more and more, which was borne out in the 1980 election, of the polarization of the country between the old morality and the new morality.
Well, where was Dan White, Milk's murderer, in this split?
Okay, Dan White was represented totally the other side. He was a native San Franciscan, Irish Catholic. Harvey was, you know, a gay Jew from New York. He was, in fact, when they were both elected on the same day in 1977, and they were put next to each other on talk show after talk show, because they both represented what the new form of district elections was meant to do, which was represent the sort of diverse neighborhoods in the city. And Dan White represented the old fashioned working class Irish Catholic neighborhood, just the way that Harvey Milk represented the new the new immigrants, gays, hippies, and those kind of people. And at first, Harvey said the guy can be educated. You know, he's not malicious. He's just dumb. And so Harvey had gotten countless arguments because he was here. Dan White, you know, former policeman, former paratrooper, considered an all-American boy. Of course, what was hidden in his past that people didn't find out about till later was he was also a bully who used to beat up the black kids who were integrating his high school. But he was portrayed as the all-American boy, and Harvey certainly wasn't, even though Harvey, I think, is more really the all-American boy in what he succeeded and accomplished. It was that was the dichotomy. And the Board of Supervisors, from the first day, the tensions, they became the arch enemies. In fact, there were times when Dan White would vote one way simply because Harvey Milk was voting the other way. Harvey's, of course, prize piece of legislation in the Board of Supervisors, other than the Puber Scooper Law, was the first comprehensive gay civil rights law that we had in San Francisco. And Dan White was the only member of the board or the city council to vote against it. And consistently, whenever Dan White had a media platform or a vote to make in the board, he would vote against gay people, and was the only politician who dared be anti-gay, because by this time gay people were so powerful that you have to be pretty dumb to be anti-gay, because you'd just get crucified if you wanted to go to higher office that would involve a citywide election. And so the tensions grew and grew. A subplot to it was that supervisors in San Francisco, as a hangover from the days when they preferred to have the ruling class sit on the board, they get paid virtually nothing. They get $800 a month. In November of 78, Dan White, Harvey's business was going – Harvey was in the process of going bankrupt. Because his business had failed, because he no longer had the time, and he was broke because of the salary. And Dan White quit. One day he just said, "I've had it," and he quit because he said, "I can't make it, and I've got a baby to support and stuff." So he quit. That meant that George Moscone, the mayor, got to appoint a replacement. Now that was very significant because there was a 6-5 conservative majority on the board of supervisors led by then board of supervisors president Dianne Feinstein, who I shouldn't say she's not conservative; she was more of a moderate. And by getting rid of Dan White, by having Dan White quit and Moscone reappointed as a replacement, that meant that there would be a liberal majority. The real estate interest and the downtown corporate interests just freaked out because all of a sudden they saw that their grasp would totally slip away from City Hall, that they had already lost the mayorship, and now they're going to lose the Board of Supervisors. An incredible pressure was put on Dan White to get back on the Board of Supervisors because Harvey had things like rent control and real estate speculation ordinances that he wanted to get passed. And it was no secret that he was just waiting for the day for Dan White to leave in order to get his proposals through the Board of Supervisors. And so Dan White, incredible pressure was put on Dan White to get back on the board. He decided to do it. George Moscone, just off the top of his head, said, "Oh, sure, a man's got a right to change his mind. I'll put you back on." And then Harvey went into his office and said, "You're up for re-election next year, George. And if you re-elect the only anti-gay member, the only anti-gay politician in the city, if you put him on that board of supervisors, I'll see to it that you don't get elected dog catcher." Because he reminded him of the simple arithmetic of George needed gay votes in order to win. George immediately saw the arithmetic on the wall and backed out from reappointing Dan White. And on the morning of November 27th, 1978, was 10 minutes away from announcing the successor to Dan White when Dan White snuck through a window in the basement of City Hall to avoid a metal detector, snuck through the back door of the mayor's office to avoid the police bodyguard. He knew about the police bodyguard because as a policeman he had once been a bodyguard for the mayor himself. And he went into George's office, shot him twice in the chest, and then execution style held his gun right next to his ears and pumped a couple more bullets in his brain, reloaded his gun, lured Harvey into his office across the hall, his supervisorial office across City Hall, murdered Harvey, and then later he went and prayed at St. Mary's Cathedral and then turned himself in. And I think sort of what I've always seen is that here you've got somebody like Dan White who at that time he was having a very troubled sexual relationship with his wife. His sex wasn't – there was something wrong sexually. This came out in the trial and I deal with it to some extent in the book. And he's about to lose everything, and why is he losing it? Why is he not getting reappointed? He's not getting reappointed because of these queers and because of their votes. And he knew what the politics were and that George was giving into the gay clout, and I think it just shook him to the bone on a very basic psychological level that this was all being taken away from him from those deviates, as he called them.
Throughout your study of Milk's life, there seems to be a premonition on his part that he's not going to live very long and that maybe be murdered.
It was so weird. On one level, of course, Harvey was probably I'm sure is the only person who from the grave has appointed his own successor. after 10 days after he was elected to the Board of Supervisors, the death threats, because that got national publicity, the death threats were so heavy that he made a tape addressed to Mayor Moscone, ironically enough, saying who should be appointed to succeed him if he's assassinated and who should not be appointed to succeed him. And one of the people he said should be appointed was indeed the person who was appointed. But so we knew about that when I started the book. And, of course, in the tape are the words, if a bullet should enter my brain, let that bullet go through every closet door in the nation. He didn't say if I get hit by a bus. He said if a bullet should go through my brain. And, of course, that is how he died. But what was interesting, that part we sort of knew on the onset of my research. But what was so fascinating is that I go back and I talk to people who knew Harvey when he was a Goldwater Republican stock analyst. And he'd be laying in a beach in Southampton. One anecdote was he had been playing volleyball, and on the other team, his team lost because on the other team was a very strong, muscular, athletic 55-year-old man. And when they were done playing, one of Harvey's friends said, gee, you know, when you get to be that age, you're going to be like that. You know, Harvey then was maybe about 32 or so, and you're good because, you know, you're in good shape, you're athletic, you don't drink, and Harvey said, no, he's 55, I'm never going to make it past 50. And the guy thought he was kidding. You know, Harvey did tell terrible jokes, so he thought he was gearing up for one of his corny jokes. And Harvey said, no, that there was something there was something down the road, a dark destiny is what he called it, and that he had something to do in his life. He didn't know what it was, but it involved his violent death before the age of 50. By the time he became a supervisor, I think those fears, and by the time he even became in public life, since there were unrelenting death threats, that I think that became a very realistic assessment. Any gay person who is on the forefront of that, or even somebody like Martin Luther King, who is really, Harvey is sort of the gay Martin Luther King now, any person like that who's on the forefront of social change is a target for assassination. So it became reasonable, except that he just got more specific and said it'd be bullets to the brain, which of course it was.
Well, his murderer was sentenced to 7 years and 8 months.
For killing both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Miller.
What were the reasons for that sentence of less than 8 years for the murder of two people?
It was one of the most shocking chapters of San Francisco criminal justice, and I know I know that newspaper reporters aren't supposed to say things like that, but you won't find a newspaper reporter in San Francisco who won't say the same thing. You had Dan White, who was a former policeman. The police department hated George Moscone because he appointed the most progressive police chief in the United States. They all of a sudden had to start treating gays as human beings. They had to start treating blacks as human beings and Latinos as human beings, which is something that they've been able to avoid doing for many years. So they hated George and they hated Harvey, and they weren't that happy. I mean, they weren't that upset to see George and Harvey get blown away. And so when they did what passed for an investigation, they did a confession of Dan White, which was all but something saying, gee, tell us what was the matter with you. It was like they scripted it for him. It was a shocking confession. They did not do an investigation of Dan White. The police didn't do anything. And the district attorney, who was in very big hot water himself because he was very, very tied up with Jonestown. And Jonestown had happened only 9 days. The suicides happened only 9 days before the assassinations. The DA was in hot water. The city was very polarized between the left and the right. And he thought, well, you know, I don't want to. He didn't want to get into the politics of it. He didn't want to get into all the ugliness of really what was behind Dan White's animosity to George and Harvey. So he did a real light prosecution, thinking, well, it's so obvious that the guy, you know, when he's sneaking past light metal detectors and doing this, he thought, well, you know, I'll just do a light prosecution. And so things went on that were unconscionable. Gay people were not allowed to sit on the jury. Potential jurors were literally asked if they had gay friends. One woman was not allowed to be on the jury because she had a gay friend. And this is not a peremptory challenge. The judge said, okay, for cause, you can't sit on the jury. And the prosecution did nothing to object. The prosecution didn't want gay people on the jury. And it was the jury was sealed off from the rest of the city. It was an almost entirely Irish Catholic jury. Seven of them were women who were Irish Catholics, and almost exactly the age as Dan White's mother. And the defense that was presented, it seems laughable, was that Dan White ate too many Twinkies and drank too much Coca-Cola. That affected his blood sugar level, and so that's why he did it. And they got away with it because there was no prosecution. And, of course, as many people know, the night that that verdict came out, a demonstration assembled on Castro Street. It was 10 to 20,000 strong. By the time it got to City Hall, and it ended up in a massive gay riot, which gays won, essentially. They drove the police out, destroyed about $1 million worth of police property. And the police got back by, they went down to the Castro, down in the heart of Harvey's neighborhood, and picked out a bar, and just a whole cadre of police just went and beat up everybody in sight. And it was like, for a day, it was like Argentina in San Francisco, with the police running wild and gays running wild. And what was stunning, as a reporter, I figured that there'd be a big backlash against gay people. It makes sense. You know, you have a riot. You know, they'll riot in full color on TV at 8 o'clock. That's the only thing you could watch on TV that night. And hardly anybody got mad because just about everybody in San Francisco agreed with the rioters that they were outraged. Even people who didn't like maybe George or Harvey just saw the miscarriage of justice. And there was never any backlash from that. It was sort of an astounding story. And then the cap it all, the next day, by coincidence, was Harvey Milk's birthday. The day after the riot was what would have been his 49th birthday. For months, there had been plans for a massive street party on Castro Street to honor his birthday. And so that night, 10,000 gay people assembled on Castro Street and boogied to Sylvester, who's the local Castro disco star, danced in the streets. I mean, only gays could have a riot one night and dance in the streets in the next. And at the end of it, everybody saying happy birthday to Harvey.
What would you say is the state of politics in San Francisco now? Feinstein replaced Moscone, Harry Britt replaced Harvey Milk. What's the balance of power now in the city?
The balance, it's gone much more moderate. It's hard to explain to people outside the city because Dianne Feinstein, compared to just about any other big city mayor in the country, is probably more liberal than certainly more accepting of gay people than just about any other big city mayor in the country. Compared to George Moscone, compared to what San Francisco had, she's a moderate to conservative, and so it's a and she's we've lost district elections, which was what Harvey and George fought so hard for, and slowly the planning commissions that were once peopled by citizens who cared about neighborhoods are being replaced by people who care about downtown and corporate interest, and so it's swinging back. But what you have is in Harry Britt, Harvey's successor, is he's a former Methodist minister from Port Arthur, Texas. What you have with him is he is the leader of the liberal wing of the Board of Supervisors. We no longer have a Chinese supervisor, so he's the de facto Chinese supervisor as well, championing the causes of Chinese Americans. And so you still have gay people as part of the most liberal political force in the city.
We don't have much time to cover this, but I've heard that one of the issues in San Francisco now is that a lot of people feel that gays are responsible for the gentrification of the Castro area,
yeah,
and of a good deal of San Francisco, and that it's driving out a lot of people of their homes. And gentrification is a big issue here, too. It's not something that I think the gay community specifically is involved with. It's much more generalized. But what do you think of that? What's your reading of that?
I think, okay, there is gentrification in San Francisco. I think it'd be happening even if it wasn't gay people. But it is happening with gay people. And I think when on one hand, we've got to be sympathetic to the plight of low-income people who are getting forced out. I wish people would understand. Well, I get a sense that people are trying to find a new reason to hate us. The old reasons to hate gay people don't hold water. They know we're not child molesters and stuff like that. So what are we now? We're vicious people who kick out blacks and Latinos. And I think what people have to also appreciate is the reason we have to move to big cities is that we're refugees, that gay people. I would be living in Portland, Oregon. I could not get a job in Portland, Oregon because they would not hire a homosexual. So I had to move to San Francisco to get a job. And I'm part of the gentrification of San Francisco. And it's not that we're viciously going in there to be nasty to poor people. It's just that, you know, that we're being driven out of other places. And that's why, you know, we need our own power base, because during the Holocaust, when Hitler didn't kill just Jews, he killed gays. And we're certainly the A number one scapegoat scapegoats today and of the new right, and it's for our own protection we need our own neighborhoods. And I think people have to be aware that we feel embattled and we've had our lives have often been embattled, and we need the protection of our own numbers.
Randy, I regret that we're running out of time, but I want to hear a little bit about what it's been like for you. You're a journalist who's openly gay, and this is something that I think very few other journalists can say in this country. You've been covering City Hall. You've been covering a lot of issues in the gay community. Were you gay when you were? Were you openly gay when you were hired? Did you come out after you were hired?
I've been open ever since college, and for years it shut doors to me. I couldn't get jobs for years and years, there were people who would not speak to me at press conferences and things, mainly closeted gay people because they were so intimidated about my openness. But now that I've written a book, now that I've been, I'm 30 years old and with 4 years of experience in TV, I've written for virtually every major publication in the country, and I've done a book which is a bestseller not only in San Francisco but in a number of cities across the country. And I've been accepted, and actually things are real easy for me. But the trouble is that people say, "Well, Randy, you're different. You can I like you, but you're different than the rest of them." I think it's like when the first blacks came along. Like a lot of times, people meet their first black person and say, "Well, gee, you're a nice guy. Therefore, you must be different than other black people." And that's sort of the little thing that rubs me is a lot of people say, "Well, then you're the exception because I'm a nice guy and easy to work with." But actually, I find a lot of it as the years go by, because of people like Harvey, because of the overall social progress we've made in San Francisco. I found nothing but acceptance in working at the Chronicle, which is one of the greatest and oldest institutions of the city.